Route 66, driving the word home. Log on to Route66Life.com. Start your journey home today.
The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Crawford Broadcasting Company, this station, or its sponsors.
Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for a half hour each weekday morning and taking your phone calls to do what we can to discuss the questions you raise about the Bible or the Christian faith. If you have an interest in discussing biblical matters or your own spiritual journey, you can call me here in the coming half hour. Actually, earlier is better because you may not get on the air if you call too late. You can call now and you can get on. The number is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. And that number will get you right through. We're going to talk first of all to Sandy from San Jose, California. Sandy, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Hey, I'm going through your Authority of Scriptures lesson. And in the third one, bravo, it's just phenomenal. I didn't call for that, but I'm telling you, I'm going through it. I just, very, very good. So thank you for that, Seth, and I'll call you when I'm finished with it. Hey, the reason I'm calling today is we're going through Bible, we're in BSF, and this year we're going through the life of Moses, which is a really good story. In Exodus 20, when the Ten Commandments are laid down, and I don't have my Bible in front of me, so I don't know exact order. Somewhere right after that, God lays down a bunch of, there's sort of civil and moral laws that go together. Israel then says, hey, we're up for it, we're going to do it. Then he goes up to Mount Sinai and gets sort of Levitical laws and some of the priest laws and the tabernacle laws and things like that. My question is, those first set of laws he gave, I think is the Book of the Covenant. I'm not quite sure, because I guess the question I'm leading to is, as Christians, well, are those first ones he gave before they gave Levitical laws, like the ones that we are to know as Christians more than we are to know those Levitical laws? Does that, am I making sense of my question?
Well, do you mean the Book of the Covenant, which is Exodus chapters 21, 22, and 23, do seem to stand out from the rest of the law? They're not, on the one hand, they're not part of the Ten Commandments, and on the other hand, they are not part of the doesn't have a lot to do with the sacrificial system in the tabernacle building. However, they do include reference to the three festivals. You know, before that section is done, he's commanding them to come to Jerusalem, or actually come to the tabernacle for three times a year and so forth for the festivals, which means they are related to the old covenant. They're not necessarily laws that all pertain to us today. However, there are among them many moral issues, moral matters that are there, and we know that the moral questions of the law really don't change. And the reason for that is that the morals of the Bible are based on God's own character, which doesn't change. The reason it's wrong to murder is because that's an act of injustice against someone's life, and God is a just God, and we're supposed to be just also. So to be unjust is sinful. And, to commit adultery is an act of unfaithfulness. And God is faithful, and we're supposed to be faithful like him. Any unfaithfulness is a sin. So we know that certain laws are based on God's own character. And the violation of those laws would be a violation of that character. And therefore, those are what we call the moral laws, because they're unchanging. They're rooted in the unchanging character of God. But there are those ceremonial laws, which includes some of the ones in the Book of the Covenant. Certainly Sabbath keeping, circumcision, keeping the festivals, offering the animal sacrifices, doing the tabernacle ritual, all, the priesthood, all that is part of the Levitical ritual laws. and those are not for today. So I would not say that the Book of the Covenant, which usually is taken to be Exodus chapters 21, 22, and 23, would necessarily apply across the board to us today, if that's what you're asking. I think it contains a lot of the moral issues that still pertain to us today, but it's not entirely, it's not a body of law that somehow has come into the new covenant unchanged.
And so when they say, when the word, the Book of the Covenant, what are the, what words do they mean? What does the Bible mean? Is it specifically Exodus 21?
It is, right. It is generally understood by Old Testament scholars that the Book of the Covenant was a document that contained the laws of Exodus 21, 22, and 23. Of course, many will know, as you do, that chapter 20 contains the Ten Commandments, and then the next three chapters are sort of expansions on the Ten Commandments, application of them to various kinds of situations. And that, okay, that application document is considered to be the Book of the Covenant.
Yeah, it says, I'm reading right now in Exodus 24:7, it says, "Then they took the Book of the Covenant and read it to the hearing of the people, and they said, 'All that the Lord has done, we will be obedient to.'" So it's really right. Those books that Israel signed up for the covenant and said, "We're going to do this." And so maybe one last question is, so then when people today will say, "Well, gosh, you know, why were you supposed to stone your daughter or, you know, do this to your son?" These laws were specifically for the people at that time that said, "Hey, we're signed up for it." It's like if I decided to join a company or whatever, and they say to me, "Hey, you know, in order to join our company, you got to do these six things." And I go, "Fine, that's to join this company. It's not necessarily to join another company." Am I saying that right, Steve?
Well, that is correct. I mean, they agreed to a covenantal relationship with God, and he laid out the terms of the covenant, and he also laid out the promises that would be there especially, which were mighty desirable. So, I mean, he was making them a sweet deal if they accepted it, and they did accept it. But that their acceptance of it means they accept all the conditions. So if you went to work at a company and they said, "Well, there's just one more thing before we hire you, you know, every Friday you have to wear a Scottish kilt to work."
Right.
Well, you might say, "Well, that's kind of ridiculous. Why would I want to wear a Scottish kilt to work?" Well, do you want to work here? You know,
right.
If you want to work here, that's
right.
What you got to do. And if you agree to that, suddenly that becomes your obligation. And if you don't do it, you can be disciplined.
Right. Very good. I'll let someone else come here. And, hey, Steve, always great. I love listening to your lectures, and we'll be in touch, okay? Oh, I did have
okay,
one.
Sandy.
Hey, Steve, real quick. Are you still there?
Yes.
Hey, the authority of Scripture, do you have the notes for those anywhere?
I do. I do have the notes for those. If you want to email me, I can attach them to an email and send them to you.
I would email you, but never email back, but I'll try. So,
never email back. I may have never emailed you back. I'm sending emails back to people all the time. I have to practice triage. I have to practice triage with the emails, you know.
I hope I'm up there on your triage list. So my apologies for saying an incorrect statement. Steve, I'll send you an email and hope to see something back, okay?
Okay, Sandy.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Sandy is referring to a lecture series that you can listen to at our website. It's called The Authority of Scripture. I used to run a school in Oregon, and the first week of the school every year was this lecture series. And I've also given that lecture series in probably 30 or more schools for Youth with a Mission over the years. It was a very important series. It starts from scratch with, you know, well, why should I believe the Bible? Why should I be a Christian? Why should I, you know, think the Old Testament has value? And what value does it have to a Christian? And why should I trust the Gospels? And, you know, why should I believe what Paul wrote? Those are the issues that are discussed in this series. If you're interested in those questions, you can go to our website. Nothing is for sale. It's all free. So you can just go to thenarrowpath.com, and you're going to click on the tab that says Topical Lectures. And when you go to the Topical Lectures, you'll find one of the sets of lectures is called The Authority of Scripture. And that's what Sandy was talking about. And obviously he liked it a lot. My wife really liked that a lot. She listened to it before she knew me, I think. And she wanted all her non-Christian friends and relatives to listen to it, I think. It's a good series for the unbeliever, the skeptic. All right, let's talk to Jonathan from Las Vegas, Nevada. Jonathan, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Morning, Steve. I will concur on your lecture series on the narrow path .com. The wonderful, actually, that's what my comment is about, is toward a radically Christian counterculture. So far,
set,
I've been through the introduction and legalism part one and two, and I could tell Bill Clinton was in office. He still had children at home. You made a couple comments as far as TV and internet. Apparently, internet's really changed in the last. How would you make, what kind of adaptations and what kind of amendments? Because I never would have got. Yeah, I think what you're, at the time, it was basically the internet. If you feel like you can't handle it, it's better not to have it in your home. But I think in 2014, internet is just about everywhere. Would you make any adaptations or amendments?
Back in the 90s when I gave that series, the internet was very new. And I didn't have much use for it. Frankly, I didn't even have a website back then. I didn't have much use for the internet except for maybe emails. But it was one of those things that in the early days was not something that most people had any real need for. It was something that had potential, but it was something that you could live without also. And you're right, the world has changed. It's very, very difficult to get along without the internet. Although some people manage it, the Amish still manage it, you know. So I don't, you know, I personally use the internet. Of course, we have a web page, and I'm even on the internet right now, communicating with the radio studio. Because of the internet, I'm able to broadcast from home, which I wasn't able to do back then. So it's, you know, there are things changed, obviously, but still, much of what was dangerous about the internet or undesirable is still true today. Of course, it has made, for example, people who have problems with pornography. It just brings it right to their home. I mean, of course, people who want to use pornography will go out and buy it anyway, but it's obviously a little less accessible before you had the internet. And there are many, you know, temptations and, frankly, errors and deception on the internet, but there's also good stuff. So it's a little bit like any other form of media. You've got to use your Christian discernment as to, you know, is it edifying? Paul said, all things are lawful to me, but not all things edify. And if some people find that having the internet simply brings temptation into their lives that they can't, they're not handling well, I would say get rid of it. And I'm not sure what you'd do. Maybe go to the library to use, email or something like that. But having internet in your home could be a real danger for certain kinds of people.
Yeah, well, it sounds kind of petty as the question came out of my mouth. Overall, I love the series. I'm excited about proceeding on with it. I just was curious, and you answered my question, so thank you.
Okay, Jonathan, thanks for your call.
All right. Bye.
God bless you. Bye now. Now, it's the second series. We don't always have callers mentioning our teaching series on the internet, but just so you know, in case you're curious, there's a series called Toward a Radically Christian Counterculture. Sounds intriguing, right? Well, it is. Most people who listen to that find it very, very helpful, sometimes life-changing. And that's called Toward a Radically Christian Counterculture. And, of course, that can be found the same place the other lecture series can, at our website, thenarrowpath.com, under the topical lectures link. Let's talk to, let's see who's been waiting longest here. It looks like Michael from Los Angeles. Actually, Michael hasn't. Michael, hold on. We got Isaac from Los Angeles. Been waiting just a bit longer. We're going to take Isaac's call first. Isaac, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, my question was on Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 1. Talks about the genealogy of Jesus. Mm-hmm. I was going over it with my brother. And we counted all the names, and there's only 13 generations there. Then it says that there's a total of 14. I was just wondering if you could clarify that. We had our thoughts of why it says 14 and there's only 13 there. We were thinking that Jesus counts as two. I don't know if you've ever encountered a question on that before
It's a classic a question, actually, because what Matthew does is he lists a bunch of names from Abraham all the way down to Christ, a genealogy of father and son, or at least so it appears to be. So-and-so begat so-and-so, who begat so-and-so, who begat so-and-so. And but then at the end of it, in verse 17, Matthew summarizes and says, so all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations, and from David until the captivity in Babylon are 14 generations, and from the captivity in Babylon until the Christ are 14 generations. That's not technically true. And Matthew knew that it wasn't technically true, and so did his readers. He was not trying to deceive anyone. What he was trying to do is he's trying to establish some symmetry that would help the memorization process of people memorizing this material. Remember, in those days, people didn't have books at home. They had to memorize things. And so what he did is he left out a few names. For example, he left out two or three of the kings in order to make the distance from David to the captivity 14 generations. He left out several generations of the kings, which we have recorded in the books of Kings and Chronicles. You know, the kings that are left out, their existence was common knowledge. So his leaving them out could never have been understood as him trying to, you know, fool anybody. Everybody knew those names were left out. What he was trying to do, I believe, is in a day where memorization was very important because people didn't have access to a lot of written books, he was trying to lay out what the chief names are in the genealogy of Christ and to break them up into three groups of equal length, 14, 14, and 14. Now, David seems to be counted twice. It would appear that David seems to be counted in the second, or in the first group and the second group. And there may be some other alterations. The genealogy, therefore, is not exact. It is correct insofar as all the names in the genealogy are real names in the genealogy of Jesus. It's just that a generation here and a generation there are left out in order to sort of squeeze the whole list into a form that can be memorized in groups of 14. And so we would not wish to use this list if we're trying to find an exact, you know, a genealogy from Abraham all the way to Christ. But we could basically see that the line runs from Abraham through David to Christ. And that's basically what Matthew says right in the first verse. He says this is the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David and the son of Abraham. So the purpose was to show that Jesus descended from Abraham and from David. And these genealogies do show that, although he leaves out a name here and there simply for the sake of artificially, really, making three groups of 14. Now, why? Why 14? Why couldn't he have left those names in and somehow found, you know, three groups of 15 or three groups of 16 or something like that? Well, no one knows for sure, but it's noticeable that he makes the dividing points pretty major points from Abraham to David, from David to the captivity, and from the captivity to Christ. These are really major historical points in Israel's history, and he, you know, he wanted to make those the punctuating marks in the genealogy as he gave it. Also, the number 14 in Hebrew would be the number of David's name. In Hebrew, the characters stand in for numbers as well. And if you take the name David and add up the value of the characters in Hebrew, it comes out to 14. Now, this would have been perhaps more obvious to Jewish readers, and Matthew's readers were Jewish, than to us. But it might also be part of his plan to connect Jesus with David, which he does right from the very first verse. And throughout the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus is sometimes referred to as the Son of David because that was a messianic title. And so to divide the genealogy of Christ into three groups that were equal, and for that number of equal parts to be 14, might even have been a subtle, or maybe not even not so subtle, way of connecting him again with David, the number 14 being the number of David's name. Those are possibilities. The problem that you observe has been observed from the time Matthew wrote his gospel on. You know, anyone can count those names, and over the 2,000 years since this was written, thousands of people have done that and said, hey, wait, what's going on here? And Matthew knew that anyone could do that. Matthew certainly if he didn't give all the names, he didn't leave any out for the sake of deceiving anyone. That'd be a fool's errand. He couldn't deceive any Jews about some of the kings of Judah that he left out. But so it's clear that he's not trying to give a technically absolutely accurate genealogy. He's trying to trace the general line from Abraham to David and from David to Christ, and that he does. But then by breaking it into groups of 14, he does that simply to, I think, for a mnemonic or a memory device. That's my impression.
Oh, okay.
You know, you find also in the genealogies of the Old Testament, for example, in Genesis 5 and in Genesis 11, you find that Genesis 5 lists 10 generations from Adam to Noah. And then Genesis 11 lists the same number, 10 generations from Noah to Abraham. And although it seems like this is a complete list in each case, some have thought since there's the equal number, 10 generations from Adam to Noah and 10 from Noah to Abraham, that perhaps Genesis is doing something very similar to what Matthew is doing, and that sometimes in the Jewish genealogies there were names that didn't have to be included in the written genealogy, because, first of all, either because everybody knew them or because the person in question was so unimportant that, you know, it didn't really matter. You know, you could just skip from one guy to his grandson because his son wasn't worth mentioning. Whatever the reasoning was, the phenomenon is exactly as you've observed. It's not exactly 14 and 14 and 14. That's an artificial thing that Matthew has done there. All right, let's talk next to Michael from Los Angeles. Thanks for waiting, Michael, and welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Good, thanks.
God bless you. I was calling about Zechariah chapter 14,
mm-hmm.
and I know I'm premillennial. I believe in the pre-trib rapture and, you know, the tribulation and everything. But this verse, I mean, this whole chapter, especially the first four verses, and with your position, partial preterism, amillennial, how do you handle that? Is it more, do you spiritualize it? You don't take it literally? But if you read it and look at it literally, it seems to indicate perhaps this is the Battle of Armageddon or a tribulation passage. How do you handle that?
Yeah, I believe it is a tribulation passage, but I believe it's the tribulation that Jesus talked about in Matthew 24. Jesus said there will be great tribulation, such as never was since the world began, nor ever shall be. And then he said, this generation will not pass until all this is fulfilled. So Jesus spoke of a time of tribulation of the Jews that would come upon them in that very generation. And it did. Jesus uttered those words probably in 30 A.D., maybe 33 A.D., something. But by 66 A.D., the Jews were embroiled in a horrible war that got worse and worse until they were slaughtered by the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands even. And their whole land was destroyed, burned. Their temple was burned down and so forth. And this was a great time of tribulation for them. And Jesus said it would happen in that generation. Now, Zechariah also is talking about such things. It talks about in verse 2 of chapter 14, I'll gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken. The house is rifled. The women will be ravished. Half the city will go into captivity. The half is not an exact portion, but all the Jews who were not slaughtered were taken into captivity. So I believe this is referring to the tribulation that Jesus spoke about in, you know, the Jewish war.
Okay, what about verses 3 and 4, especially when it says his feet shall stand upon the Mount of Olives and split it in half and all those all the things that happen there. If you take that literally, that'll be a very miraculous event. And the Lord going forth against those nations, he fights in battle. You know, how do you handle that? Has that already happened too?
Yes, that has happened also. And I don't take it literally, and there's no reason to. Zechariah is an apocryphal book. It's an apocalyptic book,
Okay.
An apocalyptic book, and like Revelation, and it's written in symbolic visions. And, for example, when you talk about, a mountain splitting in two, this is not really any more literal than, say, when God says to, I believe it's in Micah, he says, "Behold, the Lord is coming out of his place. He will come down and tread the high places of the earth. The mountains will melt under him. The valleys will split like wax in the fire, like waters poured down a steep place." Now, Micah is actually talking about a judgment that's coming on the land of Judah, and which did. But he uses the apocalyptic imagery of the mountains melt under God, the valleys split, and they melt like wax in the fire. And so also, earlier in Zechariah, a mountain is mentioned in a place that none of us take literally. And when God is encouraging Zerubbabel, whose task it is to rebuild the temple from the ruins that the Babylonians had left behind, in Zechariah 4:6, he says, "He answered and said to me, 'This is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. Who are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel, you shall become a plain.'" So here he describes a mountain being removed and becoming a plain. But this is figurative. Of course, there was no mountain that got removed. It was not. That's not what was being suggested. It's suggesting that there was an obstruction, a huge difficulty to overcome, like a mountain. A mountain in ancient times was a true obstruction to progress, because you couldn't travel over mountains then like you can today. We've got paved highways. We don't even slow down when we start going up a paved highway to a mountain. When you climbed a mountain in those days, it was seriously troublesome. So to remove a mountain was to remove an obstruction. And likewise, to split a mountain and make a valley through it is symbolic also for making a way beyond or through an obstruction. Now, what does it mean that it says his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives? Whose feet will? Well, Yahweh. That's who's mentioned in this chapter in the previous verses. Behold, the day is coming. The day of Yahweh is coming. And it says in verse 3, then Yahweh will go forth and fight against those nations. Okay, so this is one of the battles of Yahweh. And he fights against the enemies that he has. And his feet, that is Yahweh's feet, then stand on the Mount of Olives. And it figuratively speaks of splitting and making a valley for people to run through. Now, this idea of God standing on the Mount of Olives is borrowed from an earlier instance in Ezekiel chapter 11, where God stood on the Mount of Olives at the end of the chapter, and that meant that he had left Jerusalem to be taken over by its enemies, the Romans. And he's going to do the same thing, Zechariah says. I mean, actually, in Ezekiel, it was the Babylonians, but it's going to be the Romans in Zechariah. I'm obviously rushing because the music's playing. I have to be off here in about 40 seconds. But I'll tell you, if you go to my website, I have verse-by-verse studies through Zechariah, including Zechariah 14. It's at thenarrowpath.com, and you can listen to that verse by verse. I go through every verse and explain how the New Testament applies it and how they refer to other Old Testament passages. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are listener-supported. If you're interested in helping us stay on the air, you can go to our website, and there's a donations link there. It's thenarrowpath.com. Everything's free there, but you can donate at thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of KBRT, its ownership, its management, or its sponsors.
If you own a business or run a Christian organization, here's a question for you. What are you listening to right now? It's Christian radio.
So you must be sold on it or you wouldn't be listening. You listen because you get a lot out of it.
Well, so do thousands of other people who tune in here every day.
By becoming a business partner with our station, you help us stay on the air while these thousands of listeners get exposure to your business, church, or organization.
Contact us about becoming one of our business partners. Tell your friends about AM 740. K-Bright.
Here's something you may have missed on The Bottom Line.
The Border Patrol agents are downplaying nanny to all these children. We've got to care for them. We've got to put them in homes and make sure they get TB tests and make sure they go to school, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And who's going to meet their needs? And we got to provide lawyers for them instead of saying, whoa, wait a minute. That care is very nice and humanitarian, and yes, we should care for minors. But what's the end game? If you're concerned about the kids when they get here, what happens when they stay here? That's the real issue.
The Bottom Line, weekdays from 3 to 5, right here on K-Bright. Covering more people, more places than any other Christian station in California. This is 50,000 Watt KBRT and KBRT HD Costa Mesa and KNSN San Diego. also on the web at KBRT740.com.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching from her message entitled Making God's Words Our Words. It's amazing how much power words have. In a single statement, you can build something up or tear it down completely. James 3 compares the tongue to a small rudder navigating a large ship, meaning that what you say can affect so much in your life. God wants those words then to go beyond just the literal and have a positive effect on your future. In today's message, Joyce will share just how important it is to speak God's words as your own. But before she begins, we want to give you the opportunity to show the love of Christ with those who might feel forgotten. To find out what you can do, visit our website at joycemeyer.org/Christmas. Now, here's Joyce with today's teaching, Making God's Words Our Words.
Take some time when you're driving to work instead of murmuring and grumbling and complaining about the traffic and the job that you hate and how bad you feel, and just speak out loud some great things about the future of your children. You know, all four of our children are married to strong believers, and all of our grandchildren love Jesus. And when I was in those young pictures that you saw earlier, I'm talking like 35 years ago when I first got hold of the power of words, I would walk around my house during the day when nobody was there, and I had a confession list of 65 confessions, and I began to say things, none of which were a fact at that time,